Your Conversations panel series is sponsored by the York University Alumni Relations Office, and we'd like to thank them for their generous support. We would also like to thank Joseph Cesario from the Faculty of Environmental Studies over there at the back for assisting us in preparing for and just promoting and getting this panel together. At this point, I'd like to invite my colleague, Nancy Humphrey, Environmental Studies Internship Coordinator, got the title right, to come up and say a few words.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. We're really looking forward to what our panel has to say today. But I also want to let you know that we do have an internship program. It's new this year. It's a joint program between the Faculty of Environmental Studies and the Career Center. So I know that some of you are already in that internship program, and our first interns will be going out in May of this year. So I'm really excited about that. So if you're interested in it, come and talk to me afterwards.
Thank you, Nancy. Okay. So the purpose of the panel is threefold: to provide you with some inspiration and some insight and advice, and also an opportunity to connect with professionals working in various green careers, so that you can learn from them and pick their brain and hopefully get some ideas about what you'd like to do moving forward in your career. So before I begin. Just a few reminders, if you haven't already done so, we have our registration tables right on my right. And if before you leave, you can sign the attendance sheet, that would be great. And if you could turn off your cell phones and electronic devices so that we could be free of disruptions, that would be much appreciated. I also want to point out that we are videotaping this session, so if you know of any classmates or colleagues who are interested and weren't able to come, just let them know that we did videotape this session, and it will be posted on our website, yorku.ca/careers/conversations, in about a month or two. Okay. So just briefly, the panel timeline, we're going to start with, for about an hour and 15 minutes, we will have a Q&A portion, the Q&A portion of the afternoon. So I'll begin with a few questions for the panelists, and then we'll take questions from the floor. So if any of you have any questions for all of the panelists, or you'd like to address one specific panelists, feel free to do so at that point. Okay? And then the last 45 minutes of our panel will be our informal networking mix and mingle. That's an opportunity. If you're not comfortable asking questions in a large group format, that will be an opportunity for you to approach the panelists face-to-face and engage in a more private conversation or ask some more targeted questions, right? So, we wouldn't be here today without our distinguished guests, so let me introduce them to you. On my far left is Ellen Shamaria. Okay. Senior Program Advisor with the Ministry of the Environment. And all of our panelists, by the way, are York alumni. Okay. Next to Ellen is Brent Copperson, Executive Director of Windfall Ecology Center. Next to Brent is Pavel Grady Mason, Sustainability Engagement Coordinator here at York University. And next to Pavel is Colleen Cirillo, Project Coordinator with the Toronto and Region Conservation Authority. And we are hoping that Han Wu, who is planner and senior project manager with MMM Group, will be joining us shortly. Okay. So to start off, I'd like to ask our panelists if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're currently doing in your current role. So maybe we'll start with Ellen.
Sure. I graduated from York with a degree in environmental science. It was a general degree. And through a series of contracts after graduating, I slid into surface water management and have spent the last 20 plus years as a surface water specialist, water resources manager. I'm currently involved in a really interesting project, which is protecting and restoring the health of Lake Simcoe. As a senior program advisor, we're taking the legislation and the policy from the Lake Simcoe Protection Act and the Lake Simcoe Protection Plan, developing strategies and implementation plans, and taking it down into the implementation phase, which is really interesting. We get to work with a lot of stakeholders, municipalities, people in the watershed, very engaged people in the watershed, and it's It's a really interesting way of blending my science and technical work with policy.
Thank you. Brent?
Well, I'm perhaps an unlikely environmentalist. I took a circuitous route to find my passion, and I graduated from this very building, though at the time it was a business school. So I left with a business school, left the business school into a career, not in environmentalism, but found my environmental passion in the early 80s when doing a lot of flying all over the world, and couldn't help but notice the yellow pall that hung over most of the large cities in the globe, and started doing some research on my own, and became aware of what was happening to our climate, and came to a point in my career where I had an opportunity to make a choice between doing what I had been doing or making a commitment to what I had found, the passion which I had found. And I decided to spend the rest of my career, and this was, I guess, 13 years ago now, on doing what little bit I could in the fight to adapt to and mitigate our changing climate. And in 1998, founded Windfall Ecology Center, and a couple of years later, in order to support some of the community-based work on the ground that we were doing, co-founded the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association, and later the Community Power Fund, to help organizations around the province build renewable energy systems. And I should disclose that a dear friend of mine and a faculty member at FES is Dr. Jose Echeverry is on our board. So,
thank you. Pavel?
Hi, my name is Pavel Gray Mason. I'm actually the current sustainability engagement coordinator here at York University. So I hope to meet all of you later. But my path was 5 years ago, I graduated with my master's in environmental studies from York. And I actually did not get into a green career immediately. I went into student affairs and worked in residence life, but was able to take my passion for the environment and some of the things I'd learned in my degree and apply them to my work in residence life, which eventually blossomed into being hired on in this position last September, which was a very exciting step for me. And it's an exciting time for the university. As some of you may know, we've just launched our new sustainability website. Sorry, shameless plug coming. yorku.ca/sustainability. So I encourage you all to check it out and maybe take a sustainability pledge. But it's all very new. It like launched a week and a half ago, so it's good times.
Hi, my name is Colleen Strollo. When I think back to what kind of got me first engaged in the environment, I think back to Chernobyl, which I'm sure is pre most of your births, but way back in 1986, I think it was, Chernobyl happened, and at the time I was just starting high school, and that got me thinking about nuclear energy, and then I got interested in waste, and I remember my father cursing me because we bought our first house. He finally had a garage, and I just filled it up with glass and newspapers from my neighbors to take to the depots, and basically I was very annoying for most of my life for my parents. Now I look at where my kids are, and in their schools they have these eco clubs, and I just think it's fantastic how things have changed, because when I was in high school, I was the only member of the recycling group, the president, the founder, the only member. And so now I look at my kids in their schools, they have so much support to do these fantastic things, and there are solar panels on their school, and their platinum eco school, and I just think it's fantastic. My first job in the environmental field, paid job, was a horrible stint as a canvasser for Greenpeace up in Vaughan, and shoot off many porches, but that was when I was 17. And I've stuck with the field despite some challenges. My first, I guess, real job was when I was 20 and I was here at York doing my undergrad, and I got a summer job. It was a fantastic job at the TRCA. The pay was terrible, but it was fantastic. I had access to all sorts of ecologists and naturalists, and I learned a lot about the nature that surrounded me. And now I'm with the TRCA again in a full-time capacity, and I've been there for about 11 years.
Thank you very much. Hi, welcome. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you currently do in your current role?
I'm Juan Liu. It's just interesting, actually, this question about what inspires you to do what you do. I was born actually into a world of environmental degradation. I was born in Vietnam, and the legacy of Agent Orange has always colored kind of the passions I've worked with. So came to FES actually with an environmental engineering degree, but realizing that science wasn't the only thing to solve the world's problems. and you need a collective group of people. So FES provided me the opportunity to engage with artists and philosophers and urban planners. I finished a degree in urban planning, and I've been working mostly in the contaminated sites redevelopment world, so harnessing the intrinsic capital of the private sector to sort of remove contaminants from the environment and, you know, basically restore these degraded sites. And I've been mostly working in Ontario, but recently I've joined a private consulting firm and just finished a very fascinating gig in Saudi Arabia working on a master plan for Mecca. So it's sort of a pinnacle of one's career, I guess, in many ways.
What I most enjoy is the science, finding out about a lot of the emerging sciences that are coming up. There's a lot of new work that's being done around low impact development, stormwater management, new technologies, new techniques. Talking to young people, we've had co-ops for the last year, master's student co-ops, and they bring some really interesting and fresh perspectives and insights into the work that we do, because quite frankly, when you've been in a field for over 20 years, you start to have certain preconceived ideas about how things should work and how things go. And I like working with the stakeholders, with municipalities, to discuss how we can move these things forward on the ground, take it from the policy side, and to meet those goals about, you know, reducing the phosphorus on the lake and reducing the contaminants going into the lake, and how can we make it sustainable and restore the lake. So all of these aspects of the career, the field work, the policy work, the technical work, dealing with people, managing projects, are all coming together for me in this one big project, and it's just really interesting. The most challenging parts, and this is for somebody who's been in the government for over 20 years, the bureaucracy. It sounds ironic to say it, but some days it just makes you want to tear your hair out. And yet I still wouldn't change it for anything.
Okay, great, thank you.
Brent? What I love the most is working on the ground in communities, actually doing things and building things. I love to be involved in the creative and innovative design of new projects, and Windfall has done some great work in a number of areas, everything from doing the first community-wide energy efficiency retrofit program in North America with a First Nation community, which ended up being a pilot for the Ontario Power Authority, which is now being rolled out to all 134 First Nation communities. We've also done pilot work in energy efficiency retrofits in low-income communities, and now we're working, we've got 10,000 low-income homes now to retrofit over the next 3 years, and that's really exciting when we can take something from a pilot and then see how that rolls out over a period of time. We do residential and community projects in solar and provide solar installs, and been working on a wind project with a First Nation community for a few years. So doing stuff on the ground, I love. What I find the most challenging is working with government and with the bureaucratic things that happen in large institutions and governments. And as we've just heard, I mean, even those within the system have difficulty working within the system and breaking down barriers. And I think that's been extraordinarily difficult in our sector. In working towards, in Windfall's work, where we've been working in the renewable energy sector and have played a role in developing the first Ontario Standard Offer Program, which was kind of the precursor to the Green Energy and Economy Act, and then having got that and the challenges and tribulations that we've gone through has been enormous, but now we're seeing billions of dollars invested, so government does move, and when government does move, can move mountains.
Thank you very much.
I think for me, the answer to both questions is change. Because on the positive side, it's wonderful to see many varied sort of ways, concrete, positive change. More people involved, more people aware of issues. The sort of statistical things of increased amounts of things being recycled, decreased amounts of waste being created, energy being used. These are all like important and meaningful things. And you know, if everyone does something simple, you can move mountains as well, right? The challenging side, though, is in a way, it comes back to bureaucracy at times. Many people seem to have significant emotional resources invested in not changing, so it's quite hard to encourage. In a real world sort of day-to-day basis, you're having a conversation with someone who may have done things a certain way for 10 years and it's worked just fine, that actually everything they're doing is wrong and they need to do it better. And finding a way to say that in a positive, a considerate way that that will have a chance of success can be very challenging, especially as someone who, I'm personally very passionate, I'm sure everyone in this room is, about the environment, sustainability, whatever we're going to call it. And it's hard for me to want to be in a process where we take baby steps and we get there in a way that everyone can agree to. And I'm impatient to wait for consensus, but consensus is something that absolutely has to be fostered.
Colleen? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with a lot of the sentiment that's been presented here already. I think from not so much a career point of view, but just from a general, like a person who's interested in the environment and concern, it's difficult that for 25 years you see the same topics in the newspaper over and over, and even though the science has gotten to us to a certain level and awareness is so much improved, behaviors don't change always with awareness, and so it's frustrating. For 10 years I was in the stewardship section, and it was all about trying to get people to behave differently, and we pumped out a million brochures and we had so many events, but when we would do the surveys, people were behaving in the same way. They have these set patterns of behavior and we're a stubborn bunch. So that's one thing that kind of gets a bit frustrating and discouraging at times. But what is in my new role in the ecology section, what I really like is having the access and keeping up to date with all the amazing science that's going on in Ontario. In some ways, Ontario is really a leader, and there's this organization or this group of organizations that have come together called Ontario Network for Ecosystem Services, and they're doing just amazing work on, because we all get the importance of nature, but a lot of people don't, and so this is looking at nature more broadly and all the health implications, all the energy conservation implications, and so on. So that's just one example of the ways in which Ontario is leading in some of the research that's being done, and so that I find very exciting, and how that will hopefully eventually inform more policy.
What I find gratifying is going back to the places that I've worked and checking in on things, the communities, the ecosystems that I've worked on. It's never perfect, but I think it's finding hope that some generations continue on, because I think it's an evolving exercise. It's a perpetual effort to keep these systems alive and restored. So that's that. And in terms of frustrations,
what you find challenging?
I don't think that the public sector is necessarily the problem. I think it's actually sort of these binary systems and how people think. And I think this is something that I find very frustrating in the work that I do, is that environmental solutions sometimes aren't just based in sort of one career or pocket of individuals. And so sometimes refreshing ideas are the most compelling ones that get the solution done. And I think that's where I find the opportunities aren't always there, because the mindset's not there.
I think we'll stay with Han for the next question. So sort of to follow up on what a number of you have talked about, bureaucracy and winds of change and resistance to change and those kinds of things. And what advice, based on your experience and what you've seen in this field, what advice would you give to students or recent graduates who are planning a career in this field, about how to stay resilient, how to get their first foot in the door, how to stay positive and stay committed to their goals and so forth, and in light of changes in policy, changes in the public views and that kind of thing. So what advice do you have, first of all, in terms of how can they possibly get started as in their career, and then maintain the momentum and the interest and the enthusiasm that they started with.
It's funny, I when I graduated from FES, I had a colleague who studied eco-depression and the whole concept of actually trying to grapple with the world's environmental issues and how could you possibly solve it one individual at a time. So I think the key is to find your passion in whatever you do, because that's what you'll have at the end of the day left when you're totally exhausted and the community's screaming at you and everyone's upset. I think there's this belief that you are doing the right thing. And I think whatever that is, you've got to find it, because that'll always keep you going. And again, it's like, you know, some of these jobs are not perfect and they don't pay a lot, but what the passion that you bring to your new jobs or your career, your communities will inspire others. I think it becomes contagious, I hope, and that the movement becomes bigger and more things get solved.
Okay, great, thank you. Colleen?
In terms of starting out, I just think from my perspective at the TRCA, so many people that are now working full-time began as volunteers or interns, and so those are good ways to get in and to meet people and to show that you are passionate but also focused, and you don't have to address all the issues, and we all know there are so many issues, but to find the one or two that you feel you have an exceptional skill at conquering or working towards solutions. So that would be one suggestion.
Well, first off, I would request that Han doesn't go first because he stole my answer in the future. But really, I guess just to add to the, like, it is absolutely essential to know what your passion is and to be following it. And if I could just add a layer to that of have solutions as part of your passion, not just problems. It can be a bit intoxicating to think of all the problems and just get really angry and then want to go out and do something, but you have no idea what it is. So start to think about what that something is and hold on to that as part of your passion.
Well, I guess I have to say just about the same thing. I think finding what you love to do is really one of the most important things in life. And if your passion is for the environment, sometimes clarity of vision takes a while to get, but if you can manage to find it, it makes life so much more enjoyable. And as I said, I found it a little bit late in life, but I wake up every day just loving what I'm about to do during the day and take great pride in every little bit of accomplishment that we can get, and sometimes we measure it in millimeters and sometimes in larger measurements, but just try and find that passion. It's a bit of an art and a little bit of science in terms of finding that passion, and we've been helping people try and find their passion actually since 2001. I'd had some background in working with young people. I was spent some time in the music industry and did a lot of helping individuals find places in that industry, and then later did some work with entrepreneurs, helping entrepreneurs find their passion. We've kind of taken some of all those elements and put it into a program at Windfall. For us, it's all about building the core of environmentalism in the province and helping people find their passion in this area. So don't be frustrated if it doesn't come all at once, but look for it and find it and stay with it. And if you're given choices between your passion and the money, well, my advice would be to go for the passion, and the money will find you.
Tough group to follow here. I would agree on find something you're interested in doing. If you're passionate about it, so much the better, but at least be interested in it, because that will keep you coming back to work every day, even when you have the frustrations with the bureaucracy and all of the other things. In terms of starting out, try to get either volunteer positions, special projects, summer jobs in the field that you're interested in. And don't let them just stick you into a closet and do filing work, and try to push for a little bit of what the office does and what the people in the group do. When I've had summer students, when I've hired students and co-ops, I've always made sure to take them around, introduce them to the groups, take them out in the field, expose them to as much work that we do as possible, so that you get the big range of activities. The government's a big place, even the Ministry of Environment is a big place. There are a lot of opportunities, from field work to technical work to engineering work. There's policy development, there's program work. There's a huge range of work that's available, and there are places to start. Government isn't for everybody, I recognize that. There are a lot of environmental consultants out there. Conservation authorities are great places to get work experience and find a career. We work very closely with a lot of conservation authorities. Municipalities also are developing big environmental departments these days as well. So there's a lot more available now in the environmental or green career field than there was when I graduated. So I think you need to figure out what it is you want to do, the type of employer that you want to work for, and then just work towards getting that background and that experience and going for it.
I'm going to follow up with that and stay with you, Kelly. How does a student or a recent grad who has maybe not a lot of experience in the field do that? So first of all, what would you say are a few of the key skills and assets that would be helpful moving forward in a career, and how do they begin their job search? Where do they go to find these opportunities?
The Ministry of Environment has a career website. They post, the provincial government has one, it's for all ministries. They post summer jobs on there. I know the Ministry of Natural Resources posted a lot of field jobs recently. I'm not sure if they're closed or not. So look for something that's related. If you can't get a related job, try to do some volunteering with groups, that type of thing, just to get some experience around the related work. If you're interested in, you know, the biology, the water quality, the engineering, try to get field work in. I find it really important when I'm hiring people, you may be doing a lot of technical reviews, but you actually need to know what it looks like out on the ground when you're in the environment. You need to walk up and down the streams and stick your hands into the lakes and collect samples to know what it is, what those numbers that you're reading actually mean. And without that relationship, it gets really hard. So get that practical experience. If that's what you're interested in, get that practical experience however you can, whether it's coursework, some special projects, or summer jobs, and just look at the opportunities that are around, because there are a lot of opportunities around, out there for students that are eager. And that's the other thing, is that eagerness, that willingness to work.
Okay. And can you identify one skill that you think would be essential for success in a career?
Willingness to learn, to be open.
Brent.
Well, I'd have to say you're probably getting the best background that you could possibly get for a career in the environmental field at this institution. But there are very few jobs today out there that aren't in one way or another touched by environmental aspects. I mean, today, we're working with large corporations who are scratching their heads, wondering about how they are going to green their supply chains. And it's just one good example of a career path. It's probably not all that obvious to most people, but there are lots of companies there that just don't know how to do this and have tremendous power through their purchasing to make changes. So there's just about no kind of business that you could go into today that isn't one way or another impacted or could better its business by taking a more environmental approach to how it does business. So it really, what that means for you is you're going into a world where your skills are going to be increasingly valued, but you need to be adaptable to different kinds of environments, and perhaps not in places where you might have traditionally thought you would find employment. And then the only other advice I could get is use your networks and get your foot in the door and be persistent and adaptable, and that open-mindedness is really important.
Okay, great.
I read a recent article in Forbes, I think it was, that really stuck with me about there's only three things that any employer is actually ever looking for, and that's fit, skills, and attitude. So if you're feeling like you're lacking in skills, then showing them how you're the right fit and how you have the right attitude can really get you a long way into the door, and they might take a chance on you. I would say beyond that, in terms of specific skills, well, soft skills are always important, people skills, partly because they reflect on the other two areas that I just mentioned. I think it also depends on the sector, like whether you want private, public, or you know, the third sort of NGO sector. There might be some specific, like NGOs will probably much more highly value fundraising skills than the other two sectors would, for instance.
I'm just, yeah, again, that they're answering all the questions, but I'm thinking about how the places I've worked have evolved over the last few years, and say the last two, I was going to say centuries, I'm not that old, decades.
Wow.
2 decades, because I remember working, you know, first for quite a few nonprofits, and we were all really keen and really passionate, but we didn't have a lot of skill. And then everyone got smarter. So the conservation authorities got smarter, and the nonprofits got smarter. So they hired actual marketers, and they hired graphic designers, and they hired professional fundraisers. And it's just been really interesting to see how that has happened. And so it's like you said, so many different skills are required if we're going to really be going in the way we need to go. And so, say you're in this program and you have all these general environmental interests, but you have a really amazing skill with videography or photography, like, go for it. And the TRCA hires people that come to events and do that kind of thing. So even if your skill, you might think, well, I really enjoy writing, but it's not really, I'm passionate about the environment. You can put that skill to great use for the better good.
I started my career in the public sector, which I think is important because it gives you the opportunity to do a broad range of things. There's a lot of internships I find within the public sector, which I think it's a good way to start your career. I'm currently in the private sector, which is more leaner and meaner, I would say. And so one has to sort of recognize that there are skills, I think, that every sector requires and needs. You know, obviously a good technical background in something is important, something that grounds you. But I think the ability to communicate is very important these days, primarily because everything's much more team-based now, and you're communicating not even amongst English speakers, but people from other parts of the world and such. So recognize that you're working in a global environment now, and I think that's something that's important to build your career so that it's transferable from public to private, because you may go back again and forth, and that's the nature of, I think, the 21st century career now, where it's not just like you enter the Ford Motor Plant and you work there for 45 years and you retire.
Okay, great. So I think great advice. I've heard of very many common themes. So if I could summarize, so basically, the panelists are suggesting keep an open mind, be adaptable, don't be complacent, and always keep learning and growing and professionally and personally. Leverage your networks as well, identify your key skills. Make sure you know what your passion is, what you're really interested in, and then do your research to find out who's doing the things that you're interested in doing, and how can they possibly use the skills that you've got. Okay? And then I think a number of you mentioned that basically there is no organization out there that isn't impacted by the environment or environmental issues, and can use that wouldn't be able to use people with your expertise and skills. So keep your, you know, broaden your options and look sort of outside of the box and beyond traditional green careers. Okay, great. So I think at this point we can take some questions from the floor. Does anybody have a question for our panelists? Yes.
Just taking up your point about the model of working for 4 years and then retiring at the same company is kind of non-existent anymore in a lot of senses. And you know, we hear a lot of, especially here at FES, encourage interdisciplinarity, learning a lot. But I find so many times looking at potential openings at a company, they want specific hard skills a lot of the times. And so to what extent, this is open to anybody, do employers or companies actually openly look for that type of interdisciplinary approach? Are they comfortable with you pursuing a lot of different interests, not necessarily focusing on one specific skill?
So I'm just going to repeat the question for the camera. So is it more, are you asking how important is interdisciplinary, an interdisciplinary background compared to hard skills in a specific area?
Well, basically, just given the nature of companies, that are facing fiscal restraint and even shrinking government, they're looking for very specific skills. To what extent is there availability for students pursuing an interdisciplinary approach to normative study?
So are there career options for students who are interdisciplinary in nature?
Yeah, I think I'm with you. When I graduated, that was the same mantra too, that you had to be interdisciplinary, but then you enter the workforce, you got to start from somewhere. I think the key is to have something to offer the world that the world wants. It sounds kind of crazy, whatever that is, because that's your first job generally, right? And it's okay to sort of say, I did it for 10 years, I'm kind of bored and I want to do something else, or I want to grow as a professional. In my field, all the jobs I've worked in, I've worked with a range of folks, from scientists to biologists to urban designers to landscape architects to. So having that skill set is actually quite unique, ironically. There's not a lot of people who understand the environment from its full complexity. So I think it becomes an opportunity for you later on in your career. It's hard to run a team like that, right, when you're just starting out. So my advice is to sort of ground yourself in something and offer the world something that they want. Don't push things that the world doesn't want. Whatever that is.
Would anybody else like to respond?
Sure, I can. I think in the government, at least in the area that I'm in, it's a little bit more technical, a little bit more specialized. So when I've been looking for students, I'm looking for something that's environmental ecology, water resource based. So I'm looking for a little bit more technical grounding. That still leaves you with a fairly wide range of the directions that you can go in after your entry-level jobs. But I do, personally on my end, because I'm in the water resource management field, we do need something a little bit more concrete. You don't have to be specialized as a hydrologist or a specific type of fish biologist, but that more, slightly harder, let's say water resource type or environmental science background is something. I've gotten more and more specialized in some ways as my career has developed, but in other ways I've broadened other skills for the project management, the policy work, and built that on top of the harder technical skills. So it can go in a couple of different directions.
Yeah. It's a really good question for which there's no perfect answer, because it's a two-sided coin. By being knowing a little bit about a lot of things, you on the one hand, perhaps have an opportunity to qualify for more things, whereas if you specialize, one might think that you would have a better job, a better opportunity to get a job that has very specific qualifications, but in other ways that you narrow your scope. So when you're starting out, it's always harder, because it takes a while to build up your toolkit of skills. And it's very different in a government environment or in an NGO environment or in an institutional environment, where different kinds of skills are valued. So I think in part you want to maybe get a little experience in ideally in all three of those things and sort out what makes a lot of sense for you. But good employers and smart employers will look at not just the skill set the very discrete skill set that you can write down in terms of the courses you took or the degree that you have, but they're also going to be looking for the soft stuff that make leaders, and those are your communication skills and your ability to work with others and your passion for what you do. These are all very important things to display quite nakedly when in front of a potential employer.
I think I would just add that in my mind, I mean, maybe I'm still buying into the mantra, I haven't been out of FES long enough, but I think it's better life advice than career advice. Or more targeted as life advice, that if you keep your options open, you're going to need those hard skills, whatever your specific career choice is or career goals are. But having that larger skill set, that bigger picture, will stand you in better stead long term for your career and just for your happiness and for overall, I would suspect, your effectiveness too.
Can I just add something? When I worked at World Wildlife Fund and other nonprofits, there were a lot of people that had this interdisciplinary education like myself, and and we worked on campaigns, and then there were a lot of us doing the work in an office that we didn't really want to be doing. We wanted to be out in the field at the five. Researchers got the great jobs, and then there were like 50 of us doing the fundraising, the marketing, all that kind of stuff. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is think about the kind of job you want. Like if you want to be outdoors doing, you know, I don't know what it might be, water monitoring aquatic insects or whatever, then you can still have that interdisciplinary education, but you're going to also try and focus a bit on that. Like if I would have done it differently, I probably would have tried to get a little more specific with the the nature stuff, because I really do enjoy being outside more. More and more I'm inside. And anyway, so just if you can think of it that way, just where do you see yourself working, and what do you think what's going to maintain your interest over the years? The interdisciplinary stuff is never it's always a good idea. It's never a bad idea. But then I see with the TRCA, we really are also looking for people with specific skills. So whether it be someone who can do monitoring, whether it's someone who has amazing GIS skills, so we still are looking for those as well.
So what I'm hearing is that start with yourself, first of all. What are your goals? What are your passions? What are you really interested in? And then start building skills around that, getting experience around those areas. And then that's probably a good way to get started. Once you've gotten started, certainly the interdisciplinary background will help you develop and broaden your options elsewhere. Any other questions from the floor? Yes.
I do have a question. This question is in terms of, well, I guess I'm more targeting the postgraduate degree and experience that comes with postgraduate degree, and therefore how well fit is the postgraduate experience when you're applying for the jobs starting from, let's say, consulting companies and up to, let's say, field work in the government, for instance. So let's say my question comes with specification. Let's say the person gets a degree in environmental science and then gets a postgraduate degree of master's of science in hydrology. However, the field work is taking place, for instance, in a permafrost environment. So the person carries all the information, carries the background, the theory of hydrology or hydrogeology and biogeochemistry from basic disciplines. However, applies or gets experience in environments that are different from Ontario. Groundwater, obviously, and chemistry is not polluted environments. And further, this person would be interested in application of her or his experience in Ontario, just because it's just interesting to apply yourself. And how well would this person fit in this kind of application? So where would you, what kind of skills? Because, for instance, I guess I should be speaking about myself. I do have experience in biochemistry, water chemistry, something, hydrology, but it all took place in permafrost environments. But I'm interested in working with water resources in Ontario. But I see my experience does not fit well with pollution, regulation that I did not take into account, let's say, that what happens in Ontario. So how well will someone like me, a specialist like me, fit, or what kind of category should I be looking for when I'm applying, or should I be taking more certification on top of my postgraduate degree, let's say, because of the regulation of water resources?
So
that's my question. So
to clarify, your question is your academic background, your research and all of that was focused in a particular area, and then you're looking for opportunities here in Ontario, and you're wondering from an employer's point of view, how marketable your academic background would be, given that it's a different kind of environment, different specialization.
Exactly. My skills come from the general discipline. However, my experience comes from a different,
I can start with that. That's not new for me in the Ministry of Environment. Your skills are very transferable, actually. You may not have specific local knowledge, but you probably wouldn't be entering at a senior level, which is where that's more important, at a student level or a contract entry-level position. You do have the appropriate skills. In terms of legislation, that's pretty easy for you to read up on your own. The ministry has a website. All of their important information, legislation, policies are on there. So that would be pretty easy for you to look up prior to an interview or talking to the employer. In terms of field techniques, if you want to go into a hydrology or hydrogeology job, the techniques are the same. The interpreting the data may be a little bit different because, as you said, there's slightly different conditions, but the skills are very transferable. Okay, and we have hired not just students, but other new immigrants, people from that have years of experience in other countries, for example, with very different conditions. So try to read some of the reports. Conservation authorities quite often have reports posted on their websites for projects that they've done with results. Take a look at some of the information that's available on the websites, and then you'll see how we interpret things here differently than in the area where you may have the practical experience. But especially field techniques, they're very transferable.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
I think in consulting, every day is a new day, so which is great if you're interested and inquisitive and want to start your day every day as new. So most of it's client-focused, so I deal a lot with developers or with Ministry of Environment staff or municipalities. So it's all about the project per se and what the issues are and how to solve them.
I don't know. My job doesn't sound anywhere near as exciting as yours, but it's still, I still don't have a typical day. But right now, it depends on the projects I'm working on. I'm just wrapping up a project. So it was a lot of, for a few months, it was writing a report. And then yesterday we had this Queen's Park press conference and reception with MPPs. But then tomorrow I'm hanging out with a bunch of tree growers talking about invasive plants. So because my other project relates to invasive plants and the fact that a lot of those are still for sale in the province of Ontario. So it's just really different because I'm working on these different projects. Sorry.
Ditto, yeah. It's funny because working at this institution, there are days where it's, the sort of mind-numbingly like 10 hours spent in Microsoft Visio poking my eyes out, and then trying to come up with some good flow chart. But then other days it's, I get to just like hang out in Barry Hall or at a club meeting and just like talk to students and like brainstorm how we're going to fix the world. So it's really varied days. And I don't know, tomorrow my day will be tabling at the Earth Hour event. Yay, come out to Earth Hour.
Tomorrow I'm participating in two conference calls, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. The morning one is to do with a handful of colleagues talking about climate policy in the provinces across Ontario and what the hot spots and developing talking points around certain issues, some of them quite explosive. In the afternoon, I have one with the policy group with the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association talking about the impact of the recent changes to Ontario's feed-in tariff program and how to respond to those. I'm going to be visiting a unhappy client late in the day who has some issues with their rooftop solar system that I'm going to be dealing with. And the time in between will be it dealing with people things. And people things tend to be a lot of what you do as a director of an organization. So we'll be dealing with some staff issues and some other stuff.
My days vary as well. Tomorrow I've got to go up to the Lake Simcoe Region Conservation Authority for a meeting to discuss the nutrient budget results that they're working on for the last 3 years. This is all the phosphorus loading into Lake Simcoe, so we've got some numbers to review and go over and figure out where we're going. I'm also leading a couple of projects, one around phosphorus strategy implementation and the other one on to develop in-stream flow targets. So I need to wrap my head around my own projects and start moving those forward again and getting the working groups together to to start making progress on those. I've been putting some work plans together, pulling data together, and now it's probably next week or the week after, time to get the group together to actually start doing some of the work. And a lot of that work is going to end up on the Conservation Authority's shoulders because they're the ones that have the tools for that. But I've also spent a lot of time in meetings with municipalities. I've done public consultation sessions, question and answer, some phone consultations, writing strategies, putting information into other strategies and developing implementation plans, and also going out in the field and just walking up and down a creek to see what it looks like out there so that when I talk to people about it and we're developing the in-stream flow targets, that I actually have a visual picture in my head of what it is I'm talking about out there.
So it sounds like no day is the same.
They can go in chunks of the same, but I try to break them up. It keeps it more
interesting. Adaptability and diversity, like a willingness to be open, like all of you said, is really important.
And it keeps it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that interdisciplinary background will help in these roles. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, it goes back to something I said earlier. I think it was Graduate Pavan who brought up Forbes Big Three of like fit, skill, and attitude. And if you can show sort of fit and attitude that I am a person you want, I can lead a team, talk with the press, kind of do a paper. But how limiting is a lack of that academic or sort of taught skill set? So if I come to the job interview and say, I can do A, B, and C, how much do you rely, I mean, obviously there's going to be some sort of in-field training, but how much do you rely on past experience and training as opposed to, like, would you rather have someone who has done it for 10 years but can't do a paper, but I mean, we have someone else to do the paper, so we just need them to do the work, or would you rather someone who, you say, you know what, maybe we need to spend 2 weeks and they'll be slow, but after that, they'll pick up and they'll be able to do much more than that person who just has that simplified skill set, just has the skills as opposed to being fit and attitude. So how limiting is a lack of taught skills?
So speaking to what Pavel mentioned, fit, skill, and attitude, and if an individual is lacking in some of the skill areas.
I mean, yeah, but like Connie even said, like, give what you have to offer. You know? what, if you have what you have to offer, can it literally not be enough that time? Even though you're so close.
It's a competitive environment out there. So, you know, the best advice is to do your homework. And if you're going to apply for a position, find out as much as you can about the organization that you're looking to find employment with. Try and find out as much as you can about the individual who's going to be doing your interview. Just really do your homework. And that's the only way you can put your best foot forward. Employers, frankly, often make dumb hiring decisions. And I've made tons of dumb hiring decisions myself. Recently, I can tell you a story where we had a position, and I had in my mind that I was looking for a particular skill set. I wasn't following my own rules. And we hired one individual that didn't work out, who I thought was just the perfect fit, and it lasted 2 weeks. Then we hired another individual, and that really didn't work out, and that lasted not very long, and my staff were laughing at me because they had a preference for another individual who I said, okay, bring them in. So I reluctantly hired that individual on the recommendation of my staff, and she's a star. And so it's just an example. You go into a situation, it's unknown, just arm yourself the best you can, and a smart employer hopefully will see that you have passion for what you do and the ability to learn, and if you leave with that impression, I think at least you have a shot.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. The hiring process in the government is a bit more formal than that, even for students. Because it's a union-based environment that has to be very defensible, so there's, based on the job ad, there are going to be a series of questions that are based on that. If you read the ad, you'll find out what the qualifications are that are necessary, and you'll be scored on that. So all the answers that you're given and all the questions that are asked, they will be scored and ranked. So you may not have an exact fit for the skills that are there, but I'm sure that something that you've done, some kind, if you're talking about writing, for example, whether it's school projects, your thesis, or something else, think about the work that you've done, how that would fit into the position that you're applying for, and how those skills transfer over as well. You may not have actually written that technical report on something, but I'm sure you've written something else that you can use as an example, and those skills are very transferable. So it is a little bit different. If you just have the right attitude and a good fit in the government, it's probably not enough, because you'll also be interviewing people that have some of those skills. But you can also make sure that your skills relate, no matter what it is, somehow to that job that you're looking for.
Yeah, it's a tough job market out there, right? And if you have fit and skills, or fit and attitude, that can, someone might take a chance on you, but if they have someone who has fit attitude and skills, they're going to pick them most likely, especially in a more formal environment. Like my job, when I applied for it, I literally went through and created my resume and cover letter based on the job description. Like, you got to write it again each time you apply for a job. That's, you know, an obvious piece of advice, but some people don't realize that. And you know, you just, if you don't have the skills, it's still worth trying. Like, even if you don't, you're not anywhere near the job description, if you don't apply, you're going to get the same answers if you apply and they just didn't call you, right? So you might as well try and put in that effort, because you never know when lightning's going to strike. Even if you don't have skills, maybe you can show those transferable skills, or some way that you can, you know, bend things, you know, a square peg into a round hole as much as possible, while still being truthful, obviously, to show that, you know, you're the right person. You'll learn, you'll show that you'll learn really fast. You don't just say that you're a quick learner, right?
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to say that, just adding to what they said in response to your question, we often get people that come to interviews and it's clear that they don't really have the skills that we need, but we interview them because we have to do a certain amount of interviews and they might have other things that we think, you know, they're worthwhile spending the time with. And then I remember them if they've done a good interview, and they weren't intimidated by the three people, because we always have to have three people when, you know, and I always feel terrible when a 19-year-old shows up and there's three of us on one side of the table. It can be a stressful situation, and I always appreciate it when they do the resume and they come in. I think it shows great effort, and so they're on my mind if another job comes up that's kind of more suited to them.
Yeah, make an effort. I wanted to echo that. If you've shown that you've made an effort, that will get you a long way as well.
And can you elaborate on what making an effort?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's honestly, I've done a lot of hiring of entry-level student jobs, and it's really obvious which ones are form resumes and which ones were written for the job application. It's really obvious. And things like spelling mistakes, I shouldn't even need to say, but yeah. I've seen a lot of those. And showing up on time, being presentable, if you're not sure, dress up, you know, those kind of making an effort things, right?
So the Career Center at York does provide support with your job applications. So if you're looking for, you know, you're thinking, well, I have this resume, it's not the greatest resume, we want some support in strengthening it, enhancing it, and you've got questions about, I don't know if this is relevant, what I've done, you know, should I include it, should I not, we can certainly help you with that. Do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, specifically maybe for Colleen and Ellen. I was looking at a job yesterday, I was going to apply for it, but I realized I didn't have certifications. It was for like looking at invertebrates and watersheds. So, but I mean, they wanted a Ontario River monitoring certification, and the second Ontario River monitoring is like two different words, but it's a completely different certificate. When you look at an applicant, I mean, Are skills like that lack? Maybe I don't have it now, but I mean, I'm someone who can get that. I'm not worried about getting my certification. Should I run around like a chicken with its head cut off, just getting every certification out there? Or should I say, I don't have it, but I mean, I've done this and that, and another certification. I'm not worried about getting it. Give me the job, and in 2 weeks I'll have the certification. Is it, I mean, maybe that's why I asked both of you, because maybe the government's a bit different than TRC.
Do you need certifications to get the job?
I'm sorry, I don't know about that one, and I don't hire for a lot of outdoor workers, but with the certifications that we require or we suggest that you have, if you don't have them, we often offer them right up front at the beginning of the work term, but that one might be more involved.
Yeah, and for the government, if it's if it says that it requires a certification that's mandatory, then you won't be even considered without it, unfortunately, because we don't offer training necessarily up front. We expect a certain level of competence going in. And some of these certifications can take a while. So if you're hiring for, you know, a 7 or 10 week summer term, we don't have time to train you for 4 or 6 weeks on a course, for example. So unfortunately, if it does say on the government one that if it says it's an asset, then you're probably okay. If it says it's mandatory or required, then your resume would get screened out right away, unfortunately.
What about planning?
Yeah, I mean, our industry is certification based. You have to, particularly out of school, it's also an opportunity to do networking too. So if you're an urban planner or a geoscientist or a biologist, go and look to those certification organizations, because sometimes they also have internships and mentorship opportunities, and you should plug into those industry associations. I highly recommend it.
Just to add on to that, no, don't go running around and getting all of the certifications out there. Figure out what it is that you really want to do and what you're interested in, and then you can get those through your employment opportunities and other courses.
Now, from my interactions with employers, if their job postings indicate that something is an asset, yeah, I would agree with Ellen that it would be nice to have. You don't necessarily need to have that, but on your resume, you might want to emphasize, okay, I don't have the certification, but you don't necessarily say I don't have the certification, but you're going to emphasize relevant things that you've done, like projects or courses that you've taken that are somehow related to that certification or give you related skills, and you're going to emphasize those things on your resume.
When it comes to your direct involvement in the hiring process, coming from being a young professional who wants to get his foot in the door, do you find any trends that are going on with the types of people that are coming towards you? And if so, are there any inadequacies or any things that you would recommend somebody consider, especially during the interview processes that are going on?
So for those of you who are involved in hiring and recruiting, what are you seeing in the recruitment process, and are there certain pet peeves or areas of inadequacy that you're seeing and turning off?
I can start on that. I'm seeing more students with masters, higher levels of education, eagerness, people that haven't just been going through the school year, but have been involved in all kinds of projects, volunteer opportunities, special opportunities. So they're coming out, from my perspective, very qualified for a lot of these jobs, and it's making the competition in some way harder, because you're getting higher level of competencies and entry-level positions. And so it's I think it's going to be harder as students to get positions, because if you're just, one of the, let's call them an average student, there are all these overachievers out there right now, so it's going to make it harder for people looking to find jobs with us, because as has been mentioned before, you obviously take the best, and it's getting harder sometimes to distinguish between the top three if you're interviewing a group of six, for example. The research into the project or the position that you're applying for is what really stood out when I did some co-op interviews last year, are the ones that actually took the time to look up what was happening on the Lake Simcoe project. They visited the website, they took a look at it, and had an understanding of what the project was, and then they related their experience, what they were doing in school and some of the volunteer work, to the kind of job that we were advertising. And that was very clear with the ones that did and didn't. And some people didn't know what the Lake Simcoe project was all about, didn't mention the words, and then other ones had it throughout their conversation with us.
Yeah. It's Alex, isn't it? Is it Alex? Yeah. Alex is somebody who I met once and made an impression, so that's good. I would just like to echo what we've just heard. It is way more competitive out there today. And certainly the level of education is higher in those that we're seeing. There are certain skill sets that we are always looking for in our organization, and one of those is writing skills and communication skills, which vary quite widely, even with education. And as I think everybody has said, you know, do your homework, show that you understand the job that you're interviewing for and that you've done your research and you can talk about it and relate it back to your skill set, because it's so important. As you said, it's easy to spot that resume that's the form letter, especially if further down in the narrative you've got a name wrong or the company wrong, and I can't tell you how many times that happens. Just somebody is grinding those things out and they just go right into the waste bin. So.
I guess it's a good opportunity to point out that the fit, skills, and attitude thing is more around having the fit and attitude as well. So if you can show that you have the right attitude and not like a massive sense of entitlement, for instance, that's a really good way to rub me the wrong way. You know, show up like, well, I deserve this job and let me tell you why. Like, whoa, okay, I've stopped listening.
Yeah. And just the personality, I don't think we're supposed to be affected so much by personality. Like on paper, you've got these things, a person is supposed to meet these criteria, but then when I'm sitting with someone and there's just this instant good feeling, like you feel like you could really work with this person, that means a lot too. And so sense of entitlement is definitely just turns you off. I don't mind when someone says, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question, or whatever. I like sincerity as well. So not trying to be everything, because nobody is. And so, I don't know, that's what I would say.
I think you've got to look towards the future in terms of where the world of work is going. Language skills, frankly, are becoming a much more needed thing, actually. And, you know, in consulting, you can be on a plane to the Middle East or to South America or to Asia, and people have actually cross-cultural skills. These are things, actually, that people want more of. The world is shifting, if you know what I mean. And I think, you know, the centricity of power is no longer in North America anymore. And so we got to recognize that it's much more global, the environmental solutions we have, and the opportunities are much more grand at the same time. So you have to recognize that, you know, it's good to have a job in Ontario, but maybe keep an open mind and, you know, run off to the Arctic or go to South America, you know, and solve the world's problems that way too, right? You can always come back.
Any other questions?
It's interesting, just the dynamics of the different types of positions. So I'm curious to know, in each of your experiences, to what extent do you engage, or does your employer encourage you to engage in continuous professional learning? Because environmental studies, I find personally, is very dynamic, it's changing so quickly, so it requires sort of this continued education.
It's paramount, I think, for me.
How
I think,
more
yeah,
do you actually get
like,
opportunities
yeah,
from your employer?
It's interesting, because I work, you know, in a very multi-generational, and there's a certain generation that grew up with technology, and we learn all the time. And there's some generations that I've just finished my engineering degree, and that's it, 1974. And so you can realize there's a shift in our world now, where we're constantly learning because we want to and have to, right? And I think if you keep that as a question of currency, it's a very important thing. Like, and never stop learning, because the moment you do, you should be dead.
Yes, absolutely. And I feel very fortunate that at the TRCA, there isn't a huge budget for that, but there is a budget for it. And so at the beginning of the year, like just before coming here, we had a meeting about the conferences each one of us is submitting an abstract to, and in our team of seven, and which conferences we're going to go to, and we're all allowed to go to one out of province. It's not tremendous. It's not like we're traveling all over the place presenting papers or whatever, but there is a budget there. And then there are so many inexpensive or even free ways of keeping up to date and keep yourself learning. So absolutely, we're doing it all the time, and it's encouraged, which is great. But I will say that I'm working on this project that's a coalition right now of seven organizations are part of the steering committee, and the smaller nonprofits, they don't have the funds to send their staff. And so a lot of my friends that are working in nonprofits still 20 years in, they haven't had the opportunities that those at the TRCA have had, just because the budget isn't there, or they go on their own expense and they take vacation days, whereas we are paid for that time and our expenses are paid. So,
yeah, absolutely. Working at a university, professional development and continual learning is part of the job performance assessment, even, right? Plus, there's a lot of incentive to do some self-learning too, to learn how to take on different tasks and different skills and say, hey, I can do that. that really goes a long way.
Yeah, highly valued in our organization. It's a very fast-changing world, and you know, you need to keep up.
And I'll agree on the provincial government as well. We do a training and learning plan every year where you identify your priorities, what you want to learn. Unfortunately, out of province travel really isn't that feasible for us. You almost have to sell your firstborn to that. But there's certainly a lot of conferences within the province that you can do. And anything from very technical courses, very specialized ones, to management, leadership, communications types courses. And I've done both over the years, depending on where my job, my career was going. I've done the technical courses. I've done a lot of the management leadership when I started to get into management. And I've gone back to actually being able to take some of the more technical conferences, especially around the emerging technologies, which has been really interesting. So yes, it's also encouraged and required in the government.
Can I say one more thing? With the TRCA, what we do is, because everyone has their own interests and strengths, and so we do these lunch and learns a lot where, so say for instance, well, as an example, I really enjoy editing, which I know most people think is disgusting, but I'm a grammar geek, and so, you know, I'll do like a few sessions on that. Everyone brings their lunch. It's very like old school, but it works really well, and then someone else is really good at social media, and so they come in and they talk to us about social media, and so, or if someone does get to go to a conference that the rest of us cannot attend, they bring back, you know, all sorts of things, information to us. So we find ways to educate ourselves in an inexpensive way.
I think we have time for one last question. Yes.
I was just wondering, what exactly does it do?
Tell us more about MMM.
MMM is a 2,000 person big sort of engineering planning, landscape design, project management. So we do everything from building infrastructure, like airports, to highways, to community planning. We have a huge ecology group that actually works very much with the TRCA. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a broad-based consultancy.
And you mentioned earlier that being in the private sector is leaner and meaner in some ways.
Very much
so. Can
you
say more about that?
It's kind of, I mean, it's like being in a large organization, I feel like I'm in government too. It's a similar kind of bureaucratic situation, I would say, but the tendency is that you have to be very sharp. And unfortunately, you know, even in the times of austerity right now, like many of our young juniors, you know, if work's not coming in, we have to let them go. So that's just the nature of the job. So it's quite unfortunate, and you have to be part of that, ready to jump at the attention. But some of the young, you know, planners that we have, the opportunities are great. Like we have a young fellow who finished his master's and just happened to speak Spanish, so he loves sustainability and did work in South America, and guess what, he got to go with the vice president to Guatemala. So the opportunities are great. Even just because you're junior, it's not like you're you know, so it's a very dynamic institution. Yeah.
Okay. So one last question, great question.
So we're getting out of school, we've all been like working Monday to Monday. My question is, how many of you consistently get Saturday and Sunday? And if you don't, I mean, you all have to accept that, like, you were invited to a career talk, so you've all been successful to a degree. So do you think that it's that extra effort you put in when you're maybe off the clock, or when you maybe not working anymore, that has allowed you to become successful in
your career? So your question sounds like it's about work-life balance.
As well, do you get Saturday and Sunday?
Yes, I get every weekend off. I'm with the government.
Yeah.
It's actually one of, the government for me is a good fit because of the work-life balance. I did some work in consulting and contract work, and to me the work-life balance was always very important, and I didn't want to work those 14, 16-hour days chasing the business, doing the weekends. That's not to say that I haven't done it in the past when necessary. But no, I typically do get my evenings, my weekends. I did public consultation a couple of years ago. We had evening sessions because that's when you need to go talk to the public. Last summer we were doing some outreach in the Lake Simcoe watershed, and you know, the team broke up some of the weekends, so I did lose a Saturday occasionally, but that's very few and far between on the weekends. I do turn my BlackBerry off at the evenings and the weekends. and that is part of the culture that I work in. Not all government departments are like that, but that is the area that I work in, and I do cherish the fact that I have my evenings and weekends and I don't have to take home work home on a regular basis.
Friend?
The opposite. I've solved my work-life balance challenge by essentially doing things I love. So it's not really work when I come in at early in the morning. It's I'm doing something I love. I'm engaged. I still have fun with my family, and I have a large family. And did I work on the weekend? Yes, I did. Did I love it? Yes, I did. But I was also on a First Nation reserve doing my work and engaging with people that I love to engage with. So.
And is your BlackBerry always on?
My BlackBerry is always on.
How?
I do not have a BlackBerry. But I mostly get weekends off. But it's similar in a large university, I think, as government perhaps, that, you know, most weekends, yes, it's, you're really supposed to work your, you know, 40 hours a week or whatever, but occasionally when a task comes along that's important to get done, if you're one of those going, well, sorry, you know, it's, I mean, fine, you know, you're not going to be disciplined for that or anything, but no one's going to notice the great work that you put in and your commitment to the institution. So I I know it seemed like I was finished. So if duty calls, as it were, I've been, you know, happy to be to stay and get it done because I, you know, like Brent as well, I'm just really enjoying my work, so it doesn't feel like a job. You know, if it felt like a job, I'd probably go home.
I not only get the weekends off, I get Fridays off.
Oh, what?
Yeah. But I don't get paid for that. But what happened was in stewardship a few years ago, because stewardship, we had to fundraise. Someone came back from mat leave, I came back from parental leave. We were like, we wanted to keep the three of us on. We all took a pay cut and we all took a day off. And then the three of us were able to stay working, and I have not gone back because I love having Fridays off. So I took a pay cut, and I love it. And I've read a bunch of stuff on, you know, the four-day week or even the two-hour week. There's a book about that. But I think you can be really efficient. I don't go out for lunch. I don't, with a lot of people, like, there's a lot of socializing that goes on, and I probably appear fairly antisocial at work, but it's because I get my job done in 4 days, and I go home, and I have 3 days off with my children, so it's not a break. But it's fun, and I really like it, so... Yeah, and I don't have a BlackBerry either.
I have an iPhone and a BlackBerry, so it's interesting. I mean, the last 3 years I've been working in the Middle East, so our clients' weekends start on Saturday, and so Thursdays, Fridays is their day off. So in consulting, you take advantage of that kind of opportunity, so
yeah.
It's kind of interesting that my schedule's shifted. When I worked in the city of Toronto, I mean, evening and weekend meetings were sort of given public consultations, dealing with counselors, and that was your job, was at night, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a night walker, but, you know, that's sort of the situation you have to deal with. That. But if you love your work and you know that that's where your work happens, it doesn't become work, it becomes opportunities for engagement and, you know, and taking advantage of every moment that you have to yourself is critical to the work-life balance, to recognize that time to yourself is actually nourishment time too, right? So.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So,
good question.
This brings our formal Q&A portion of the afternoon to an end. The purpose of the panel really was to give you an opportunity to hear about some career paths that you can possibly take in this field, and to hopefully be a little inspired by our panelists. Certainly have been, but it's very evident how passionate and how passionate you are and how much you enjoy your work. So I want to thank our panelists, so Juan Liu, Colleen Cirillo, Pavel Gray Mason, Brent Popperson, and Ellen Shmarin, for coming. Please let everybody give them a big round of applause.